Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we've got Tammy back with us. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so let me just go through the obligatories. If it's now or never, that debt is fraud. You're welcome to join the Loud and Liberty, you know, prayer circle. You're welcome to give me your contact information and your campaign. As I said yesterday, you're well behind the eight ball now. You need to get your campaign going, folks, because if you're filing this year for an election this year, you're well behind. And if you're filing for next year, you're still well behind because you need to get petitions. You need to get people out there, because what you're going to be doing if your election is next year for the county commissioners, what you're going to be doing is you're going to actually be going out and getting people to sign petitions to go, you know, stop the invasion and send that into your county commissioners. And so as you get some signatures, you go in and say, hey, we the people want you to do something about this invasion and tell that state legislature to step up. And if you've got county commissioners that you know, like the majority of those in Wyoming that need to be replaced, then they're probably not going to do anything. They'll say, just take this up to the legislature and go, well, actually, in a Republican form of government, you're my representative, or maybe we shouldn't be voting for you. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and as a matter of fact, you know, you can help them. But actually, if you really have somebody that's going to be a bonehead, they don't deserve the help. But if there's somebody that really could actually get on board, then you need to, you know, give them some tutelage, tutor them, mentor them, what have you. But I'd even say this, that in some cases you may have somebody that might actually, you know, be able to listen and so forth. First thing you've got to tell them that they are the ones that have to deal with this. This is nothing that goes to a lawyer. When it comes to the Constitution and petitioning our legislators, our government, that is not something that the lawyers are involved in at all. And if they seek guidance from the lawyer instead of actually asking you, where in the heck are we, you know, why are you doing this to us and so forth? In other words, they should be going to you folks to say, you know, why hast thou done this to us? You know, kind of thing. So, and you need to help them understand that this is a Republican form of government. And as a matter of fact, this is the email I'm communicating out to the states this week. That, you know, why do we call them sovereigns? Why are the legislatures, why is Congress considered the sovereign out of these different government bodies? Because, and as a matter of fact, we're going to get into this, right? So when we hit the ratification debates, which is going to be very, very soon, we'll actually cover all of this. But what is important, and I'll just say this, because this came out of Mr. Grayson, and actually Mr. Grayson was an anti-federalist. In other words, he wasn't a proponent. He was an opponent to the Constitution. But one of the things he kind of points out, because he was challenging this concept of two separate sovereigns. And so this is what he says. As to direct taxation, give up this and you give up everything, as it is the highest act of sovereignty. So who has that ability of direct taxation? If you grant it, it is the highest level of sovereignty in government. That is your legislature. That's why Congress has that ability. That's why your legislature in your state has that ability. Mm-hmm. And he goes on and he says down here, and he goes, suppose, and I'm just not reading the whole thing, but suppose a state and federal execution issued this against the same man and the same state officer and federal officer seized him at the same moment. Would they divide the man in two as Solomon directed the child to be divided? Who is claimed by two women? I suppose the general government is being paramount would prevail. How are two legislatures, i.e. the state and federal, to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? For such is the definition of a legislature. So the whole point is, he's giving us a lesson on what a legislature is in a Republican form of government. Now, how many people have ever taught you that? That the legislatures are sovereign, and that is because their abilities to tax, their abilities to create law, make law go away, and so forth and so on. And the fact that they are omnipotent and transcendent and supreme. See, the framers understood government. We don't. And as a matter of fact, that's why the judiciary is getting away with murder. But that being said, folks, what we're going to do, though, today is we're actually going to dive into these amendments that were proposed to the Articles of Confederation. There were a total of eight, or was it seven? A total of eight. And so we're on the fifth one. We read the first four. Now, let me lay this out. For a half century, there has been a lobbyist organization of one kind or another, and money, an obscene amount of money, has been pouring into this organization to convince state legislatures to give them a blank check of creating a constitutional convention by petitioning Congress to call forth this constitutional convention. Now, the reality is that when we look at a constitutional convention, or even the amendment process, because the amendment process can only do one of four things. The one thing it can do is it can fix a deficit, a deficiency, a defect in the Constitution. Or it can grant additional roles, responsibilities, powers, property, what have you, to the federal government. Or it could remove roles, responsibilities, powers, and or property from the federal government to possess. Or, and the fourth and final thing, is that it can become an opportunity to rewrite the Constitution. We're going through a melee of amendments sought by both Continental Congress and people in the states. And yet the state legislatures were not willing to, or at least because it required 100%, Rhode Island was the 1% that chose not to pass anything. They basically says, we don't care, you know, we don't even care. I don't even think Rhode Island was being represented in Continental Congress anymore because they couldn't afford it. And so here is absolutely a state. And as a matter of fact, they had they put this in the Continental Congress Articles of Confederation regarding Continental Congress, had they actually put in that a state that withdraws their representation is considered out of the Union or Confederacy. Therefore, they could have actually said, okay, so Rhode Island, you're not here, then, you know, we're not sending this amendment out to you. It's not applicable to you, and bypassed it that way. But that would have required an amendment that Rhode Island, because that didn't that language didn't exist in the original text. So Rhode Island would actually have to, you know, kind of pass that because they did pass the Articles of Confederation. Does that make sense? Okay. So, all right. Now, what we're looking at in this next one is this amendment. And let me see here. I'll pull it up so I can read it. This is a grant of temporary power to collect import duties and request for supplemental funds. And this was on April 18th, 1783. In other words, this is just a month after. So this is the Fifth Amendment, and it's just 1 month after the Articles of Confederation was ratified. The fifth one. Oh. Okay. So one would think that, okay, they're having some problems.
Yeah.
All right. And this is interesting because they start off with the fact that we've got 9 states that actually agree that we need to do this. So let's go ahead and pick it up with the resolve by the 9 states.
Okay. Resolved by 9 states that it be recommended to the several states as indispensably necessary to the restoration of public credit and to the punctual and honorable discharge of the public debts to invest the United States in Congress assembled with the power to levy for the use of the United States the following duties upon goods imported into the said states from any foreign port, island, or plantation. I'm going to list all of these.
Yep, let's go through them. Yeah, because... Okay. Yeah, go ahead. And I think when you look at the do, that is...
That's dollars.
Dollars, yeah, right.
So, yeah, okay. Okay, upon all rum of Jamaica proof per gallon, 4/90 of a dollar. Upon all other spirituous liquors, 3/90. Upon Madeira wine, 12/90. Upon all other wines, 60/90 of a dollar. Upon common bohiti per pound, 6/90. Upon all other teas, 24/90. Upon pepper per pound, 3/90. Upon brown sugar per pound, 1/2/90. Upon loaf sugar, 2/90. Upon all other sugars, 1/90. Upon molasses per gallon, 1/90. Upon cocoa and coffee per gallon, 1/90 of a dollar. Upon all other goods, a duty of 5% ad valorem at the time and place of importation. Okay, provided that none of the said duties shall be applied to any other purpose than the discharge of the interest or principal of the debts contracted on the faith of the United States for supporting the war agreeably to the resolution of the 16th day of December last, nor be continued for a longer term than 25 years, and provided that the collectors of the said duties shall be appointed by the states within which their offices are to be respectively exercised, but when so appointed, shall be amenable to and removable by the United States in Congress assembled alone, and in case any state shall not make such appointment within 1 month after notice given for that purpose, the appointment may be made by the United States in Congress assembled. That it be further recommended to the several states to establish for a term limited to 25 years and to appropriate to the discharge of the interest and principal of the debts contracted on the faith of the United States for supporting the war substantial and effectual revenues of such nature as they may judge most convenient for supplying their respective proportions of $1,500,000 annually, exclusive of the aforementioned duties, which proportion shall be fixed and equalized from time to time, according to the rule which is or may be prescribed by the Articles of the Confederation, and in case the revenues established by any state shall at any time yield a sum exceeding its actual proportion, the excess shall be refunded to it, and in case the revenues of any state shall be found to be deficient, the immediate deficiency shall be made up by such state with as little delay as possible, and a future deficiency guarded against any enlargement of the revenues established, provided that until the rule of the Confederation can be carried into practice, the proportions of said
$1.5 million.
Yeah. $1.5 million shall be as followed. What's the VIS stand for?
As follows VIS. Legal term, like as to wit.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay. All right.
So New Hampshire, 52,708. Massachusetts, 224,427. Rhode Island, 32,318. Connecticut, 132,091. New York, 128,243,000. New Jersey, 83,358. Pennsylvania, 205,189. Delaware, 22,443. Maryland, 141,517. Virginia, 256,487. North Carolina, $109,006. South Carolina, $96,183. And Georgia, $16,030.
Go ahead, the last of it.
The said last mentioned revenues to be collected by persons appointed as aforesaid, but to be carried to the separate credit and states within which they shall be collected, that an annual account of the proceeds and application of all the aforementioned revenues shall be made out and transmitted to the several states, distinguishing the proceeds of each of the specified articles and the amount of the whole revenue received from each state, together with the allowances made to the several officers employed in the collection of said revenues.
Okay, so interestingly enough, let's point out a few things because it's nice to be able to take a glimpse at history and one, what they think would be a fair form of taxation. In other words, they needed to go after commodities that were kind of equally consumed amongst the states because had they gone after a commodity that was really, let's say, horse feed. We knew that the majority of the horses were in the South. And so if they went after like a horse feed, if there was such a thing as a commodity being imported, that would have been a tax that only the southern states could have actually been able to pay. The northern states would have, either been penalized or what have you. So they needed to make sure that they went after things that were pretty commonly used. And as a matter of fact, so rum and the liquors were staples. I mean, that was right on the very top, right? And so, and actually, they,
Rum and all spirits is liquors.
and alcohols as well, because if you look at the, other than starting with the T, the one, two, three, the top four, 4 90ths, 3 90ths, 12 90ths for Madeira wine. Boy, you can tell they were, they didn't like the people that were producing Madeira wine. Or it was very popular in the States because 12 90ths, that's actually the 24 90ths on all other teas. So in other words, it seemed like everybody was consuming teas. But they definitely went after, because the rest of them is kind of half twos, one, one, one. The amount was minuscule in contrast to the teas and liquor. And as a matter of fact, did they have coffee on here? Cocoa and
Yeah, that's at
coffee.
the
At the very bottom, 1 90th, cocoa and coffee. And actually, the other thing that was very, very popular, obviously, because I noticed that they didn't touch salt. Salt was so essential, they didn't want to touch that. But pepper was one of those niceties to add, to give your, because I guess they had a pretty bland diet. If you've ever eaten English food, it is pretty bland. And I think most of the Northern European foods are kind of lacking, heat, things that I like. But anyway, nevertheless, nevertheless. But the other thing we can garner out of this is who are the two states that were hit with the highest taxation? Well, obviously, that was Virginia, number one. Number two was Massachusetts. And then coming in a close third was Pennsylvania. But here's the interesting thing, because I actually have the population of of these states. And when we look at Virginia had the highest of 691,000 citizens. And the next highest one, let me see here, technically was Pennsylvania. That's the next highest of 483. The next highest was North Carolina, 393. And then Massachusetts of 378. So, I mean, they came in like fourth or fifth.
Oh, that's weird.
It is weird. And so, and Massachusetts, if you look at the amount, Massachusetts is half the population of Virginia. and they're almost carrying the same burden financially.
Do you know why that is?
No, I didn't know, other than the fact that they may have not had a census. And the Constitution actually established a census.
I see.
So, I mean, the maybe the last census they had may have been the by Britain itself, but where the king wanted to know how many citizens, so they had a census. But let's look at it this way, too. When we look at the what caused the Constitutional Convention, one of the real catalysts behind it was the Shay Rebellion. And what was the Shay Rebellion? It was a rebellion of the those in Massachusetts that felt that they were being overtaxed, and it was just the burden on them was too much.
Yeah.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Okay. So, and you can see this. I mean, it should have been half that. As we started looking at population, I don't know why they were laying this out, but did they actually put it in that there would be a census or something like that? I didn't see that.
I didn't read that.
Okay. But because they did say that they were going to apply this, you know, across, and then it would be amended later. And so anyway, yeah. I think that Continental Congress was, you know, sticking it to Massachusetts. I don't know. Anyway, so it's always interesting with the snapshots you can get from historical documents like this. As a matter of fact, I love reading the president's inaugural address, you know, and their State of the Unions. If you go through the history of those, you'll actually find, you know, what the prevailing problems were, what their focuses were, and so forth. It's like a little snapshot at, you know, at an executive view of what the country needs to do, you know, for some strategy or what have you, because it's always been that way. And so that's where, and it was via these inaugural addresses that I discovered that Madison, and actually, I haven't gone into it, and I've asked people for the different bank charters for the First and Second National Bank. Now, forgive me for diving into this. I've got basically about a minute and a half to do this. And so the first charter that was written for the National Bank was done by Hamilton, which gave the bank a lot of latitude. I believe the second charter was more defined in scope and limited. And so because this was Madison doing this. Now, everybody's, oh, a bank charter is a bank charter is a bank charter. Well, let's look at those because that's what I really want to do. But in Madison's bank charter, they had a plan of paying off the debt. And so in so doing, I think that that was actually baked as a part of the charter or the legislation for the bank. And so when Monroe was giving his first inaugural address, or maybe it was his second inaugural address, he actually spoke about the debt of the United States in the war and how, you know, we were well on plan of actually having that debt paid off early. And guess who happened to be in office when that debt got paid off?
Who?
Jackson. And guess who took credit for paying, getting us out of debt?
Jackson.
There you go. All thank you very much to Hamilton, and he's the guy that killed the charter of the bank. So not knowing what was really happening at that point in time and the charter and so forth, I'm apprehensive. Well, let me finish this when we come back because I want Tammy to hear this. So with that, we will take a pause. We'll come back and we'll dive into more of these amendments, but let me give you my apprehension when we come back of why I don't want to give Jackson, you know, carte blanche credit because, well, I'll tell you why in a minute. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we've got the microphone, and now Tammy can hear what I'm saying, because I didn't want to go into breaks telling the audience what my apprehension was and you not hear it. My apprehension in giving Andrew Jackson credit for, or even any type of credit, was due to the fact that here was a guy that sent thousands of Indians unconstitutionally on the Trail of Tears. Here was a man that actually created the spoil system out of appointments. In other words, when we really look at the very first Democratic president, was a opportunist in using the government funding for rewarding his loyalists. That never really happened. And as a matter of fact, I know Madison really tried to avoid that. And I think that the men in those first early years were, you know, very conscientious that they didn't want to have any type of, you know, air or even the appearance of creating favoritism and paying off loyalists. And yet it was Jackson who actually was the one that put it on steroids, or actually, you know, started really utilizing that. And, when we look at the Democratic Party, we look at the big difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. One stark difference is the Democratic Party has, you know, these outrageous parties, debauchery and what have you. And one of the things that Jackson was known for was having, you know, very loose parties in the White House. And I don't mean debauchery type, but I mean, because I remember reading a book about him, and I think at that point in time, he wasn't married. Now, I know that Thomas Jefferson wasn't married, and he may have had parties, but he didn't, you know, entertain the way Jackson did. And as a matter of fact, you know, it was many a times there were people that were kind of passed out. So when we look at how he's quick to take credit, he was definitely an opportunist. I look at one of his first gestures as a new congressman. When George Washington was walking into Congress to basically, transfer the seat of the executive power from himself to John Adams, and everybody stood up and took their hats off, except for Andrew Jackson. He kept his hat on. In other words, as a gesture of respect, when Washington entered the room, everybody took their hats off, except for him.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so it kind of gives, you know, these little things can kind of give you the character of the man. Now, maybe very rebellious and those types of things, but he got into office and he got into politics due to the fact of his, you know, flamboyant career as an officer in the cavalry and in the army. And technically, that army shouldn't have been existing. technically. But because Washington was an army man, and all of the presidents were kind of army men, except for Adams. The two Adamses were really naval guys because they saw the need and the importance of the naval, you know, building up the Navy and so forth. But anyway, but I digress. What we want to do now is we actually want to take a gander at the Sixth Amendment. And the Sixth Amendment, let me see here, go back to where I was. Okay, so this is the grant of temporary power to regulate commerce. Now, not even, well, let's look at what they're going to regulate, because when you look at the U.S. Constitution, Congress has the power to regulate commerce among foreign nations. Among the states, they don't have the power to regulate commerce within the states or the states specifically, only among the states, and they have the power to regulate Indian tribes, the commerce with Indian tribes. So, okay. So let's take a look at what they were seeking and if it was in line with the Constitution or if it was maybe a little more aggressive. Let's go ahead.
Okay. The trust reposed in Congress renders it their duty to be attentive to the conduct of foreign nations and to prevent or restrain, as far may be, all such proceedings as might prove injurious to the United States. The situation of commerce at this time claims the attention of the several states, and a few objects of greater importance can present themselves to their notice. The fortune of every citizen is interested in the success thereof, for it is the constant source of wealth and incentive to industry, and the value of our produce and our land must ever rise or fall in proportion to their prosperous or adverse state of trade. Already has Great Britain adopted regulations destructive of our commerce with her West India Islands. There was reason to expect that measures so unequal and so little calculated to promote mercantile intercourse would not be preserved in by an enlightened nation. But these measures are growing into system. It would be the duty of Congress, as it is their wish, to meet the attempts of Great Britain with similar restrictions on her commerce. But their powers on this head are not explicit, and the propositions made by legislatures of the several states render it necessary to take the general sense of the Union on this subject. Unless the United States and Congress assembled shall be vested with powers competent to the protection of commerce, they can never commend reciprocal advantages in trade, and without these, our foreign commerce must decline and eventually be annihilated. Hence, it is necessary that the state should be explicit and fix on some effectual mode by which foreign commerce not founded on principles of equality may be restrained. That the United States may be enabled to secure such items, they have resolved that it be, and it hereby is recommended to the legislatures of the several states to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years with power to prohibit any goods, wares, or merchandise from being imported into or exported from any of the states, and vessels belonging to or navigated by the subjects of any power with whom these states shall not have formed treaties of commerce. Resolved that it be and it hereby is recommended to the legislature of the several states to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years with the power of prohibiting the subjects of any foreign state, kingdom, or empire, unless authorized by treaty, from importing into the United States any goods, wares, or merchandise which are not the produce or manufacture of the dominions of the sovereign whose subjects they are, provided that to all acts of the United States and Congress assembled in pursuance of the above powers, the assent of 9 states shall be necessary.
Only 9 states, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so interesting. All right, well, now we want to go into the next one. Any comments on this, though? I mean, it looks like they're definitely trying to mingle more directly into the states.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I guess when we get to the notes on Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, we'll kind of find out, you know, why the states were more apprehensive. Nah, we don't want this general government getting in our knickers of how we're going to make our chairs and how we're going to weave our wool and blah, 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 blah. Right? And so just remember, folks, today they regulate the amount of wattage your light bulb can actually consume.
Yeah.
And how much your toilet water, you know, how much water your toilet can flush. I don't believe that that is within the those concepts of regulating commerce among the states.
Yeah, definitely not.
Okay, so anyway, let's go to the next one. And
okay.
Let me see here. The next one being an amendment to grant commercial powers to Congress. Now, this is the 28th of March. This is 2 years after the ratification of the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That the first paragraph of the ninth of the Articles of Confederation be altered so as to read thus, the United States and Congress.
Hold on here. So let me actually, because they're going to change, they're altering it to be read as thus. So let me actually pull up the ninth article, Articles of Confederation. And this is the first paragraph of the ninth article, right? So the ninth article. Now, this is what it says. I'll read this, and then you read what they're going to change it to. The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and allowances or alliances, provided that no treaty of commerce shall be made whereby the legislative power of the respective states shall be restrained from imposing such imposts and duties on foreigners as their own people are subjected to, or from prohibiting the exportation or importation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land and water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided or appropriated, of granting letters of marque and reprisals in times of, or marque, and reprisals in times of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining final appeals in all cases captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed a judge of any of the said courts. And so now let's go ahead and read that to see how much difference this is going to be.
Okay. It is the same until the first dash.
Okay.
So the United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, of regulating the trade of the states as well with foreign nations as with each other, and of laying such imposts and duties upon imports and exports as may be necessary for the purpose, provided that the citizens of the state shall in no instance be subjected to pay higher imposts and duties than those imposed on the subjects of foreign powers, provided also that the legislative power of the several states shall not be restrained from prohibiting the importation or exportation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, provided also that all such duties as may be imposed shall be collected under the authority and accrue to the use of the states in which the same shall be payable. And provided, hold on, I lost my place. And provided, lastly, that every act of Congress for the above purpose shall have the assent of 9 states in Congress assembled, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land or water, and everything else after this is the same, shall be,
Okay. So, It seems like they're actually allowing the states a little more latitude. Am I wrong or am I right?
I don't know. I'm kind of confused, to be honest.
Okay, because it seems like they're basically making sure that the states will be able to, you know, collect taxes on imposts and those types of things. And as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, in the Constitution, states are prohibited from doing that on any foreign goods.
Okay.
So, interestingly, I guess what they're trying, they're looking to grant this commercial powers to Congress. So let's look at what powers are they granting them that is actually different? Entering into treaties and alliances, okay, so at the very beginning, it looks like their treaties and alliances are to actually be supreme. And so, because that was one of the problems, that the states were creating their own treaties and creating edges and advantages with, you know, above other states and so forth. And so there was definitely economic warfare that was being waged by states amongst other states in trying to get bigger advantages. Well, you know, when you look at Virginia was they were the biggest consumer on the block, right? Now, when we look at the consumption of goods, is there any nation that consumes refined goods, you know, like electronics, cameras, and those types of things? Is there any nation that consumes appliances and, you know, consumable products like that bigger than the United States? And when we
Japan,
look,
China.
Well, actually, they export. They produce it. But they don't import. We consume and import their crap.
Gotcha.
Where we are the big consumers of the world. Which is why when we place tariffs on foreign goods like wine and such, you know, America is almost like Babylon, because there's a party every night and, you know, we're just completely numb to the hardships that are, you know, being experienced in all other nations around the world. Now, Britain is, you know, being taken over because, you know, they've been open to many of these types of, invasions by Islam and so forth. But when we look at all the other nations of the world, we are the biggest consumer. This is why we have, when we look at our trade deficit, that's one of those things that I think is where Trump has actually made headway in changing that in his first presidency, and I think he's going to try to do that in this presidency as well. Because when you have a trade deficit, the value of the dollar goes down. And when you actually, you know, have a surplus of trade, the value of the dollar goes up. In other words, when we're exporting more goods than importing with one nation to another, in other words, we have an advantage then. And I know there's economics and tied to this, but when we look at the number one exporter in the world today, that's China. And that's because we've gotten out of manufacturing. We may be manufacturing around the world, but China is where it's coming from, the majority of stuff and crap coming from. And so we've lost the economic war because we have gone out of our way in making China the most favored nation status, giving them most favored nation status, which is unconstitutional in the first place. The fact that Nixon pulled that rabbit out of his hat is just absolutely amazing that Congress let him do it.
Yeah, why did he do it?
Because I believe that there was a viewed need for being able, because this is just my view. when you look at China, it is one of the only nations that has been a communal form of government for a long time. In other words, the people have kind of acceded that they all need to get along, and they've created dynasties, and they've had their factions and rebellions over thousands of years, but they've been more communal because of the arduous property and landscape of China. And so, for whatever reason, they have gravitated towards more of a communal, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, the transition, or I should say the communist revolution, from a dynasty, from a, you know, basically a mercantile ruler who controlled everything anyway, to move into a communist, most of the people of China didn't see any difference until the food ran out. When Mao basically killed millions because they starved to death. Now, but most people really didn't see much of a difference between one or the other because they've been, you know, controlled to that level. And so when we look at China, China was the perfect case because they were very close, they were isolated, and as a communist world, you see, Russia was competing and they were exporting all of their military goods and so forth for years after World War II. Even China was a consumer of the Russian MiGs and so forth. And so because they were not capable of that kind of manufacturing. And so when Nixon finally said, we're going to give them the most favored nation status for trade and so forth, what that did was it basically focused a huge level of, I'll just say, what's the word? Subsidizing. This huge subsidizing of the Chinese economy in making them what they are today. Now, just remember that in the 80s and in the early 90s, when Clinton started giving them our technology, most of their military technology institutions, a lot of these facilities had dirt floors. Today, you look at China, and it's almost like, you know, how you can't even imagine that. I mean, you really have to get out there. But China has become this huge hub of, I'll just say, the most evil. You know, we look at it, I just used in the same show, I've called America the Babylon of the world. But actually, China is the ultimate Babylon ever. Just due to the fact that they do anything and everything to their people. They've captivated millions of people and made their bodies available for, you know, transplant. All you got to do is have no morals, get on a plane, fly there, and you can get a kidney for $60,000. They'll kill somebody to give you their kidney.
Wow.
So
I've heard about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, you got to – what kind of person – can actually pay, you know, and say, I believe my life is greater, worth more than that person there, and get on a plane and actually do that.
Yeah, that's messed up.
Yeah, it is. It's a level of evil that I don't think Sodom and Gomorrah could fathom, and I don't think, you know, even during Christ's time, the apostles could fathom, but there's no doubt Christ knew. There's no doubt, you know, our creator knew it, when this nation was being created, the evils that would actually be descended upon mankind. So anyway, anyhow. All right. So we've kind of killed off another amendment. That was 7. So we have one more left and we got 3 minutes to do it. And actually, I just don't think we're going to get it done. Let me take a look at it, though, because...
Yes.
Let me see here.
It's a little long for 3 minutes.
Let me see here. Yeah, it is a long one. So we'll address this next. Now, what are we going to do after this? And actually, let me ask you, Tammy, because I've kind of leaned on the ratification debates, but sequentially, the notes on the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, are really, really important, because there are things that happen in the Constitutional Convention where they walk away and go, okay, this is done. You know, like admitting states into the Union. You really do not find much, you know, discord amongst the anti-federalists about the admission of new states into the Union. So it might be good to just, you know, take some of those topics out of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention so that we can kind of look at that. The suffrage in the Senate, the framing, this what I would call the Sherman Compromise in creating a Senate that would have representation for the states. Kind of an interesting thing. Now, these are only notes of general that Madison captured. You got to remember that there were multiple subcommittees that were out kind of explaining and doing things to where Madison may not have captured, you know, all those different comments and those observations and so forth. I mean, you got what, 50, 60 some men in this big room, and, you know, maybe these side rooms and so forth that Independence Hall had. And so he couldn't capture everything. It's like, you know, it'd be a nightmare unless you actually had a microphone and technology to isolate what each person was actually saying, so you could create a transcript of everybody. Anyway, it's amazing that we have the level of information that we have today. I'll just say that. And as a matter of fact, I believe that that was the work of the divine hand of providence to make sure that these records were kept and preserved, because had we not had these, then we would not have any understanding, and we would be basically being tossed to and fro by those people who want to tell us what they think happened. Now, as we look at history and we look at what they could have done by destroying these things, I believe that in America, that would have tipped the evil hand. Oh, look, they're trying to destroy the ratification debates. That must mean there's something special about that. Because In America, every time there's been an attempt to go after and destroy, or, you know, like the Beatles, you know, destroying the Beatles records or what have you, did that make them less popular? No. And as a matter of fact, more and more people want to go, why? Then let me go listen to this. Why are these people, you know, trying to censor this? And that, nine times out of ten in America, it has an opposite effect. Does that not make sense?
I mean, it's done that for Trump.
Yeah, you know, I actually have a bulldog that requires the opposite type of orders and commands. I say, you know, go away, Maggie, and she'll come to me, or I'll say, come here, and then she'll go away. So anyway, as we go through all of this, we'll find out from Tammy tomorrow what we're going to be doing next after this, because I think it's critical that we lay this out and that you can have all the profound understanding of the Constitution. That's what we're here for, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.